Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Hikomo podcast, hosted by myself, William, and co-host Hannah. The Hikomo podcast is all about helping you discover career options by sharing career insights from people working across a range of industries. Today, we are joined by an experienced clinical physiologist who specializes in respiratory and sleep physiology. He has a first-class degree in healthcare science. He has experience of working in both public and private healthcare sectors. And he's also the co-founder of IP Diagnostics, who specialize in sleep and neurological diagnostic testing. So if you're somebody that's struggling to get a quality night's sleep, then I think you're really going to enjoy this show, on top of all the great career advice that our guest is able to share. So please join us in welcoming Julius Patrick.
Waiting for the rest of the crowd to join in.
Yeah, I said on the last episode that we need to get a live audience.
Definitely. Or
get sound effects for the clap. I might get that added in after. But yeah, thanks so much for joining us, Julius, and coming on the Hikomo podcast. It's a real pleasure to have you. And I'm sure our guests, you know, as I mentioned in the intro, the ones who are struggling to get a good night's sleep, I think they're really going to benefit from some of the insight you'll be able to give, as well as all of the great career advice. So before we jump into the show, we usually like to start with a little game, two truths and a lie. So yeah, hand over to you, Julius.
Well, thank you for inviting me to speak here today. You know, I think it's a brilliant thing that you're doing, and yeah, hopefully can provide some source of value for people to pick up. So two truths and a lie. So do I tell you, I just say three statements and you got a guess, or how
exactly
does it work?
That.
Exactly, yeah. That. Okay. So you will die quicker from sleep deprivation than food deprivation.
Okay.
You've got to guess it now, or shall I read out all the
You've
other
got to give
read out all of
three.
Okay. Approximately 30% of the population suffer with some form of sleep complaint. And you can function on 5 hours sleep per night.
Wait, say the second one again, please.
Approximately 30% of the population suffer with some form of sleep complaint at any given time.
I think that one's the lie. I think the percentage will be higher.
Same. I think it'll be higher as well.
Yeah, because what was the first one? You said you're more likely to die from
sleep deprivation than food deprivation.
Yeah, I think if you go a week without, yeah, if you went a week without food, you'd probably be struggling. But yeah, I reckon the percentage of people is higher than 30%. So I reckon that one's the lie.
Are you in agreement, Hannah?
I believe so.
It's wrong. It's 1-0.
I think that's the first time we lost.
You should get right. 30%
is the figure that's, you know, statistically given. I'm sure the number is higher than that, but that's the rough figure we get. So
he was right.
So it's wrong. If you're gonna do your research, that's the figure you will find. 30%.
Okay. All right, cool.
So yeah, you can't function on 5 hours sleep per night without any emotional, physical, or mental consequences. There's a small proportion of the population that can, which has got a genetic basis.
Hands up.
So don't fool yourself in trying to cut your hours short, because you know you will suffer, whether you notice it or not.
Is that dependent on age as well?
No, it's not dependent on age. You know, the recommendation for adults is 6 to 8 hours. You know, some people can function on 6, but anything below 5 is, you know, you're killing yourself there.
What about in terms of, if, say, for example, if you go Monday to Friday on about 5 hours sleep, but then you kind of have a day or two where you have much longer episodes of sleep, does that help? Or
no, it doesn't help, because over for that week that you're getting 5 hours of sleep, you're building up a sleep debt, so we call it. So when you have this rebound sleep where you're sleeping for longer, you still can't fully, you can't get back the sleep you lost. You know, the damage is already done to your body. You know, your body will try to recoup the lost sleep, but it's a debt you can't actually pay off. And that's a sign. If you're doing 5 hours of sleep and then on the weekend you're sleeping 12 hours, you know, it's a sign that something's wrong. You should be sleeping consistently, regular, times every day.
So yeah, so I think we should get into some of the questions around sleep, because things like coffee. So a lot of people are coffee drinkers now. How much of an effect does that have on your sleep?
Yeah, so some people are more prone to the effects of caffeine than others. But coffee, how it works. So how we sleep, for you to understand the effects of coffee, there's two processes that govern sleep. One is the circadian rhythm, 24-hour biological process, so light and dark cycle. And the other is a sleep pressure, which is a buildup of this chemical in the brain called adenosine. So the longer you're awake, the more adenosine builds up. And when you sleep, it drops. It's like resetting the gauge. Caffeine actually blocks the effect of adenosine in the brain. So that's why you feel awake. But the problem with that is when coffee runs out or the half-life wears off, all the adenosine floods back and then you get this caffeine crash and you become knackered. So it does. And obviously, the more caffeine you drink towards bedtime, obviously the more it's going to affect your sleep.
Okay, so that is true. It's not a myth.
A myth at all. But we do recommend that you have your last cup of coffee early afternoon. That is a standard recommendation in the sleep world.
Cool. And then in terms of people who struggle with a good night's sleep, what tend to be the main reasons that you find for your patients, the reasons why they struggle to sleep?
So mostly people suffer with anxieties and worries, like we all do. So insomnia is the number one sleep disorder, and the main cause of that is through anxiety, worry, remunerative thoughts, keeping yourself awake at night. And this is normal. We can all have poor night's sleep because of worries and bills and debts and things like that. Some people are more predisposed to having these anxieties than other people. There's normally an event that precipitates the insomnia. So, like a trauma event or,
exams.
Exams, exactly, especially for the people listening to this. And then it's the things that we do after that to try and compensate for the lack of sleep. So we perpetuate the problem by drinking more coffee, napping in the daytime, and all these little things that actually make the problem worse long term. And then it changes from short term or acute insomnia to chronic and long term. So the number one thing, to answer the question, is worry, anxiety is probably the number one.
Okay, number cool. So then in terms of tips if people are struggling to get sleep the night before an exam or leading up to an exam or an interview or any other important event, what do you have, like a few tips that you could give for people to manage that?
Leading up to, again, it's all about how you manage your stress as an individual. For things like this, I like to promote things like meditation. That's a technique that works for me just because it quiets the mind down. So when you start having these thoughts and these anxieties, then it's just about taking your thought process away from your head and back into the moment. So that's the main thing I would promote, is meditation. Yeah.
Is it a myth that if you go on a screen or you go on your phone or any sort of device before you go to bed, does that actually hinder your ability to sleep?
It does a little bit. I think now the data is starting to show probably not as much as it's being portrayed in the media, but the science behind that is the light emitting from the device tricks the brain to think that it's still daytime. So it stops the production of melatonin, which is like the sleep signaling neurotransmitter. So it's supposed to be dark in the evening, so melatonin is released and then we go to sleep, but the light kind of delays that process, so we will stay up a little bit later.
Awesome. Okay, so I haven't been lied to, that's actually the truth.
But then there's a thing called bedtime resistance syndrome. We feel like we've missed out on scrolling in the daytime, or we missed out on the news, so we're in bed and we're like, because you feel like, I'm not ready to sleep yet, I haven't got enough of my dopamine hit from my Instagram. So I think that's also goes hand in hand with that,
because people use it to wind down. Often it's doing quite the opposite.
Get a book out, good old-fashioned paper book, have a bath, you know, a hot bath, hot shower. It's important to have a nice evening wind down routine, especially if you're one of those that's struggling for sleep, you know.
Cool.
How's your sleep?
My sleep, I mean, I follow the advice of if you sleep this, like you go to bed at the same time and wake up at the same time and you have that sort of routine, then you feel like nourished in a sort of way. So I try to do 8 hours, but my sleep isn't that bad. So I will find this quite useful, but I think other people find this even more useful, especially if they're stressed out in terms of exams, etc.
Yeah.
Or even just in general from anxiety.
Yeah, yeah. And also, you know, when it comes to worrying, you know, the things that you, 95% of the things we worry about don't happen anyway. So it's about, you know, just understanding that, you know, it's all things that we do to ourselves. You know what I mean?
That's so true. That is so true.
So when did you first know that you wanted to be a sleep physiologist?
I didn't. I never knew that, actually. So when I first joined the hospital that I was at, I joined the reception staff. I didn't even know what a sleep physiologist was, to be honest with you. And just the way things progressed and the way opportunities came up, did I kind of fall into that field? And I actually started doing respiratory physiology, which then led to sleep physiology. But I think it's important to know, you know, no matter where you are, it's not where you're going to end up. Do you know what I mean? Which is very important. As I said, I didn't even know what a sleep physiologist was, but now I love it. I genuinely love my job and I'm grateful that I get to do this every day.
For those that don't know what a sleep physiologist is, could you give them a quick definition?
Yeah, so by trade, we work in clinics or hospitals and we're responsible for connecting sleep studies. So people come to us with a potential underlying sleep disorder, such as sleep apnea, which is where you stop breathing for intermittent periods of time overnight. Snoring is a big risk factor. So any snorers out there, you know, could be a sign of sleep apnea. So people come to us for a sleep study, pretty much. And then we'll wire them up in the sleep lab and then we'll go through the data and we'll make a report to the consultant. And we'd also give out treatment for these disorders, such as a CPAP machine, which is like a mask on the face that blows air to keep the airway open. And then, yeah, if you really enjoy what you do, you give out sleep tips and advice to people, you know what I mean?
Do you medicate them as well? Is there certain...
I don't medicate. I haven't got the...
Oh, okay.
I'm not a doctor. So
okay, cool. Doctors have to prescribe the pills.
Yeah, yeah. And again, when it comes to medication, I think that, you know, sleep meds are also overused. People got some insomnia. They go to see their GP and they will provide them with a Z drug or something to knock them out when actually, you know, you're not treating the cause of the problem or even looking at it. And nowadays, the main or the recommended first line treatment for insomnia is something called cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia, which is much more effective than all these drugs that the GPs are giving out. So it's about raising awareness. Obviously, some disorders need medication to some degree, but in terms of insomnia, I'm not a big fan.
It's about getting to the root of the problem.
Always, always.
So did you have to go to university to be a sleep physiologist, and are there other routes that you could have taken to get to where you are now?
Yeah, I did have to go to university. Luckily enough for me, my place of employment paid for that. And they provided an opportunity for me that, you know, looking back, I probably didn't even want to do it. Just came at the time and it was something that, yeah, I just jumped on. But yeah, you do have to go to university. It was a 3-year degree studying respiratory and sleep physiology. Very interesting. I do recommend it if there's anyone looking for a little bit of an alternative route to medicine out there, because you do get exposed to the cardiac side, the neurophysiology side. It's quite extensive. I really enjoyed it.
What university did you go to, and how did it get funded, and what was the program that you went through for them to fund it for you?
I went to University of the West of England, and it was quite a new degree at the time because I was still working full time and it was a full time degree. So I wasn't sure how it was going to work. And it was the first year. We was like the guinea pig year of how it was going to work. But yeah, it worked out very well because everything you're studying, you're going back to work the next day and applying directly. So, you know, by the time the degree had finished, I felt like I was already a senior physiologist because I had already been, you know, throughout the 3 years, I was, you know, every day, every single day. It's not like doing a degree, coming out and then trying to put it into practice. So, yeah, these degrees are normally placed while in a placement or in a hospital, you know, so it's not like something you can go and do it on your own. But I recommend, you know, doing it in conjunction with a place of work.
Yeah, and I think that's a really key point around how you're, because with a lot of degrees, when you're not in a place of work, you learn a lot of theory and you're absorbing a lot of theory, but you're not really understanding sometimes the application of that theory.
100%.
So being able to study a degree whilst working, I think you must get much more benefit from it and pick things up a lot quicker because you're seeing the theoretical and the practical come together. Rather than, I think, doing a degree for myself, for example, doing a degree and then going into work, you're then trying to work out, well, all that theory that I learned, how does it now apply to practice?
Yeah, I don't even remember half of it now.
Yeah. Or things happen and you're like, oh, actually, then you start to connect the dots.
Yeah.
But I think doing the two together, I can really see the benefits of that. So, yeah, great point.
And it's, you know, in the NHS, they do a lot of trainee programs for people who want to get into physiology, and they're all funded as well, so you know, definitely something people should consider if they want to get into healthcare.
Did you always have a background that was quite like medicine based, or you know, in that type of field? And what A-levels did you do? Do you, if you remember back that far?
Yeah, I'm not that old. Yeah, so again, funny enough, I never had a medical background. I came to this hospital just looking for, you know, a better life. I came from Luton when, you know, I pretty much reached the end of what I can do. You know, it's one path or the other path. So I moved to London to just try anything new. That wasn't medicine. That was just to get a better job, better salary, better way of life. And A-levels, funny enough, I did do biology at A-levels and I got a U. Ungraded.
Oh, no. Yeah. Oh, really?
Which just goes to show you where you are, it's not where you're finished. Not because, you know, well, yeah, I did struggle with the theory, but also I was just in a different place mentally then. And then to come out after that and get a first class degree in science just goes to show you, you go from a U to that in a few years. Like, what
was that switch? Like, what made you make that crazy turn, basically?
Well, I just started investing in myself, you know, mentally. I started reading a lot more. I started taking time out to understand myself, to better understand the world around me. You know, as I say, meditating a lot, reading a lot, spending time on my own, and just, you know, just trying to become a better person in myself. And I think that just put me on a path of focus, and things just started opening up when you do things like that.
Could I just pick up on that quote that you used around where you are is not where you're finished or where you're at? I think that's such a strong or powerful point, in that, you know, sometimes you're not always going to get the grade or achieve success in the first instance. But if you don't give up and you keep going, actually you can find that you will achieve that success and achieve your goals.
Yeah.
I think that's a great example of it. You know, you didn't excel at, say, biology at school because it might not have at that point, it didn't feel like an area of interest. But then now, further down, you've been able to actually identify that interest and excel at it, which, yeah, I think is really inspiring.
And, you know, success is a bunch of losses compounded on each other until you win. You know, there's not been one, you know, success story where someone's gone from zero to success. You know, you have to slip along the way. You have to get comfortable with, you know, dodging the punches of life. You know what I mean? It's part of the journey. So yeah, don't be disheartened if you take a little loss now and then. You know, the more losses you take, the more experience you get. And that will eventually lead to success.
Well put. That is very well put. So in terms of the qualifications that you actually need to become a sleep physiologist, obviously you went down the degree route. Are there any other alternative routes that you could have taken?
It's, as sleep is still quite a new field in medicine, you know, it's probably the newest field, and it's growing rapidly, as you can probably tell from the consumer sleep side of things out there. Right now it's a university thing, but you can go and get sleep experience if you're in a hospital, if you're a nurse, if you're a healthcare assistant, or, you know, if you're in the hospital, you can go out your way to get sleep experience. But, you know, to get that proper qualification, you would have to go to university.
Awesome. And on a day-to-day basis, what would you say, well, you touched on this before, but what would you say you do in the day? What does your job entail?
Well, right now it entails a lot of different things, because we started our own company to do sleep diagnostics. So it's a lot more busy than just being in the clinic. But on a standard day-to-day, you know, you'd load up the screen with all the data that you've recorded from a previous night's sleep study, which is pretty cool. You get to see brain waves, you get to see the different stages we go through during different periods of sleep, which I still find fascinating. So we spend quite a lot of time scoring sleep studies, and then, as I say, going to set up people in their home, which is always nice, you know, meeting very interesting people on a day-to-day basis. So yeah, very lucky and blessed.
So would you say your job is still easy to do remotely, given the pandemic?
It's easy to do. It is easy to do. And I think that's primarily why we started up this company, was looking at the data of people coming into hospital for sleep studies. You know, you come into a different environment, and we have this thing called the first night effect, where the brain actually doesn't sleep as deeply as it would in your own bed. So you come in for a sleep study to get diagnosed for a sleep condition, but actually you don't sleep. So then you spent this money and, you know, you've got no real credible data. So go into people's houses, stops them from traveling during this pandemic. You know, we go to them, they get a better night's sleep. So yeah, it's been a win-win in that regard.
So it's definitely more effective.
Yeah, definitely more effective, I would say.
And you have worked in the NHS, correct? And you've also worked in the more private side of things. What are the differences between the two, and which did you prefer?
Preference, I wouldn't say I preferred either. I think they both came with their own experiences. And challenges. Definitely in the NHS, you see a much more wider scope of conditions and more extreme versions of that. And in the private world, you see much more of the more common sleep disorders. So it's a good contrast on both ends. And I think for any physiologist, it's important to get experience in both fields.
Definitely. Okay, so what skills would you say are critical to you being a sleep physiologist?
I think communication skills, because you know, for me, definitely number one has helped me a lot, because you spend up to 2 hours one on one with these people. You know, you're putting things on their heads, you know, you're putting things on their legs. You know, it's quite an intimate, almost personal setup. And it can be quite awkward sometimes. So, you know, you have to have a little bit of banter, break the ice now and then. So I think communication skills, definitely. And in terms of that, I wouldn't say you need to worry about your science or your maths and things like that. You know, I think all of these things, I still would, you know, it's okay to say that the schooling system, I still feel, is outdated to this day. I think all of these things that, you know, we have to have, don't really have real world application in all the jobs, unless you're an accountant, Billy. You know, you need to know your maths, you know what I mean? But I think, you know, I wouldn't say there's any particular skill apart from being a good communicator.
Interpersonal skills.
Yeah, interpersonal skills, because you also deal with a lot of doctors and nurses and, you know, people on the wards and things like that. So yeah, but it all comes down to being able to talk and communicate yourself properly, I'd say.
Definitely. What would you say is the best part of your job, and what would you say is the most challenging?
As I say, I enjoy the setups. I enjoy going to people's homes, you know, not knowing what you're going to expect. I enjoy that process of setting up a patient, talking to them, understanding their fears, because sometimes just through the communication pre-setup, you'll understand that actually maybe this sleep study is not necessary. Maybe I've already kind of know what the problem is. Maybe this person's drinking 20 cups of coffee a day, you know. Sometimes it's, and that wouldn't even have come out if you don't have time to, you know, to sit and talk. And the most challenging, I would say, is scoring a study on a complex patient. So sometimes we go and see patients who have traumatic brain injuries, for say, or who are in a vegetative state, and you know, trying to find something in an EEG that's completely flat or in data that's not your typical average data, I think is the challenges. But it's good because then we refer back to the literature. You know, it makes you learn a bit more. You have to get the books back out, and you know, you have to start again. So it's a challenge, but you know, I enjoy that because then it also makes me better. You know what I mean?
Yeah, you have to have those good analytical skills as well.
Yeah,
to 100%. Read through the data, etc.
And patience.
Yeah.
Patience.
Why would you need patience?
Just because sometimes it takes, you know, to score a study, if it's one of those complex ones, it can take six plus hours, you know.
Wow, so that can be quite taxing. Wow.
Yeah. So it's just about taking a step back, go out, have a little drink, come back, and you know, because then you see it differently as well. Sometimes I'll come back and I see it completely different.
Or you have like a fresh pair of eyes that looks at it.
Exactly.
Yeah. In terms of that, actually, what type of hours do you work? Is it quite flexible? And do you just have to set up the patient to do the sleep study? Or do you have to actually be up and like basically check up on them while they're doing it?
So traditionally, these studies are done in a hospital setting, and in the NHS, they do attended studies. So you've got physiologists that do shift patterns. So 9 to 5, they'll come in the morning, they will score the studies, they will give out the CPAP machines, they will, you know, perform clinics, things like that. And then you've got the ones that will do the, you know, 12 to 8, which will include the setup of the patient when they come in at 6. And then you've got people that will stay overnight just to watch the data and make sure nothing's coming off. But what we do now, we go to set the patient up. We've got, you know, very particular fixatives. So we, you know, we don't lose electrodes, touch wood, we haven't yet. And then we can remote into the data. So if they've got any problems, we can have a look on the computer and see what they're talking about.
What do you prefer to work? What hours do you tend to work?
I work every hour of every day. Yeah. But that's me. I enjoy my work, you know. I live to work. So I enjoy that. But as I say, you can work whichever hours you want in a shift pattern if you've got a big enough team.
Awesome. Do you often get a lot of people reach out to you for advice, like your friends and family, in terms of sleep? Because it seems to be a lot of what you discuss.
Yeah. No, I enjoy that. I enjoy that. And they do hit me up quite often. And it's nice when you see something so small, one little small piece of advice makes such a big difference. It's rewarding. It's really rewarding.
In fact, how did you get into meditation and reading? Because I feel like they're very, very good sort of patterns and routines to have in your life.
Yeah. So actually my sister and my mum are quite spiritual people. And I remember I must have been about 18, 19. And I was just like, these lot are crazy, man. Do you know what I mean? I just didn't understand it. I didn't get it. I just slowly started to, you know, to understand it, just gave it a little go. They work for me. You know, I love reading, I love meditation. Like, I think these are fundamental things that everyone should do to some degree. You know, I mean, there's lots of many different books and different techniques out there. You know, if one thing don't work for you, you know, pick it up. And that's one thing as well, I used to pick up a book, and if I didn't like the book, I'd still finish it because I felt I'm too invested. But now, if you don't like the menu, get out of the restaurant. You know what I mean? So
it takes a lot of discipline to do that, actually.
Yeah,
to finish a book you don't even like.
You will. I just thought that, yeah, I don't know, that was just me. But yeah, I think I enjoy reading a lot.
Could you recommend a book to our listeners?
Yeah, so I would recommend The Power of Now by Eckhart Tolle. That's just about embracing the present moment, and realizing that the voice in your head is actually nothing, is not you, it's not your real essence, it's your conditioning, it's our worries and concerns that have been put there by, you know, our environment. So The Power of Now, number one, and I would recommend in terms of mind state, Think and Grow Rich by Napoleon Hill. Just gets you into that state of understanding. You become what you think about. You know, success is a mind state. Failure is a mind state. And it's just about recognizing how you can use your thoughts to your advantage. And we can control, I believe we can control our environment by having the correct head on.
It's incredible.
We have a few sentences or phrases that I'll start off and then we look for you to finish. So the first one is, success to me means?
Success to me means getting what you want. The happiness is enjoying what you want.
Okay, cool. And then, I wish I had known.
That life is all quite simple.
Cool. I thought you were going to do Forrest Gump, life's like a box of chocolates. Okay, cool. I think that's good advice because sometimes, you know, we can overcomplicate things rather than kind of going back to basics, first principles, keeping things simple when problems arise.
Exactly.
So I think that's great advice. The best advice I could give?
The best advice I could give is, again, it's not my quote, but I will, you know, it's helped me a lot. So Einstein once said, you can't solve a problem from the same level of consciousness that created it. So take a step back, chill, you know, you can't move forward with that same racing mind, you know. So I think that's helped me a lot over the life.
Thanks. No, that's really, really, really helpful advice. I think all the sleep tips you've been able to give and insights into sleep physiology are really going to help our audience. And really, hopefully, it will resonate and they'll explore clinical physiology as a career option. Would you like to give a shout out in terms of your business, IP?
Yeah,
diagnostics, so and where people can find you.
Physiological Diagnostics, that's us, that's our logo. It's myself, Julius, and my colleague, Dr. Leon James. Check out the website, ipdiagnostics.co.uk. We've got sleep tips up there, you know, if you want some more information on sleep disorders, or if you want to reach out, if you've got a little problem, you know, we're happy to help. So yeah, get at us.
Oh, can I just ask another question?
Go on.
So what led you to start your own business essentially, and how challenging was it to do that initially?
Yeah, challenging, still having challenges every day. But that's part of life. You grow, you learn, you know, you bounce back. So what led us to starting it is we worked at the same hospital and we started this similar business. So these home studies. And we just felt that the place of work could have been doing a lot more to promote it. We felt like this is something that's rich, could be a really big thing. And we should, you know, we should encourage physiologists to go out to the patient's home. And, you know, we're getting much better data that way. And there was just more of a, you know, we were so passionate about it and they were not as passionate. So, you know, you can't let, you know, in that situation, you can't let your passion die. Saw a gap in the market. And again, we went for it. We went for it. So it's, as I say, it's something that we're passionate about, you know, which I think is number one if you're going to start a business of any sort, because it ain't easy. You know, there are challenges like day to day. So the passion and your reasons why have to be at the forefront of your mind to keep you going.
Great. And then I think also on that, did you find that timing's important as well? Because I think people always have passions or ideas to start businesses, but sometimes it doesn't feel like the right time, or there's a few different things they need to go through to then realize that actually, yep, now's the time to start. What's kind of your advice in terms of people that are considering timing and not sure whether to start a business?
I'd say don't wait, because you know, whether you do it now or you want to do it in 6 months, the time will pass anyway. So you will be much, you know, even you would have more progress if you started now than in 6 months. Whether it's slow progress, it's better than no progress. You know, the timing's never right. You know what I mean? If you've got an idea, go for it. Life is short. You don't want to have them regrets on your deathbed thinking, I wish that I'd done that, I wish that I started this. you know. And for me, that's also something I think I just couldn't have lived with the regret.
Great. I think that's actually a great place to end it. I think with that point around, if you've got an idea, start now. Don't waste time.
Start now. And again, reach out if you got, you know, if you want any sort of tips or I can offer any advice on the journey that I've gone through, you know what I mean? I'm happy to do that.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Julius. Really appreciate you coming on the show. Thank you, everyone who's tuned in and listening. Hannah, thank you as well.
Thank you. Thank you. That was so fascinating.
Thank you, guys. A pleasure to be invited to do this. Yeah, very grateful.
Great. Thank you very much. See you on the next episode.